Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Daisy De La Rosa. I'm with the Boston Public Health Commission. I'm currently overseeing the committee's Putting Prevention to Work. And I am not Dr. Barbara Ferrer. I am presenting for her. She called me about an hour ago and said that she was not able to come. And so in public health, you have to be ready for the unexpected. And here I am. I'm very disappointed that she didn't send me half as exciting slides as the gentleman here and pictures. And I'm also feeling awkward that we made a top 10 best list of cities there. And I'm talk about inequities in a minute. But here we are. Taking action to eliminate health inequities in Boston, and there are no financial relationships to this close. I wanted to share that in Boston, 1.5 to Boston residents, Boston Black residents, are 1.5 to 9 times more likely to experience higher rates of morbidity and mortality, except for some health indicators that are highlighted in dark there. And these differences have persisted for decades and exist in a city with near universal healthcare coverage, as you know, 13 teaching hospitals, 26 community health centers, and world-renowned colleges and universities. And the differences start at birth, where we have Black babies in 2008 were four times more likely to die in the first year of life when compared to white babies. It's very sad to know that the death rate for Black babies in 2008 is about what the death rate was for white babies 25 years ago. And it persists throughout the life course, resulting in Black residents in Boston living on average 5 years less than white residents. We see that, you know, Boston is a city with a significant amount of residential segregation, as seen on the map in the right-hand corner. Black residents are highly concentrated in the neighborhoods of Roxbury, Dorchester, and Mattapan. And these are the same neighborhoods that we see highest rates of foreclosures, children with elevated lead levels, and heart disease and asthma hospitalizations. Similarly, these are the same neighborhoods with the highest rates of homicides, obesity. And although the city of Boston offers its residents many opportunities for recreation, as seen here, available parks, open spaces, such as urban wild areas, farms, beaches, there are differences by neighborhood in what is available. For example, there are many fewer bike trails in Mattapan, Roxbury, and Dorchester than in our more affluent neighborhoods. And this is a priority for the Boston Public Health Commission, starting with our framework here, a model of social determinants of health. At the Commission, we have used this information to create a model that allows us to better understand the role of social determinants of health in affecting health outcomes, with a particular focus on the tremendous impact of racism on health. So we know that many institutions that affect social determinants have been shaped traditionally by racism. Here are some efforts that Boston has taken to address racial and ethnic inequities in health. And we see we've published under the leadership of Mayor Menino and with support from community-based organizations, hospitals, health centers, and business and faith-based communities and residents, we developed a blueprint for eliminating health inequities 6 years ago, and you can find that at our website there. Our objective at the Boston Public Health Commission is to support activities that will achieve racial and ethnic health equity through community policy and system changes. And we're achieving that by following our core strategies and guiding principles. Core strategies include data gathering and information sharing, community investment, and changing policy and practice. And we're also guided by our principles, commitment to racial justice, commitment to social change, accountability to the community, integrity in our internal and external processes, and collaboration and shared learning. Throughout the commission, we ask that action planning take into account the following five directives: evidence-based foundation, community learning, capacity building, and coalition development are the pillars of the work. Inequity is considered as a central issue, and elimination strategies are integrated into core public health functions. We work upstream with non-traditional partners, and this is required to address root causes of inequities. Funding is directed to support efforts to eliminate inequities. As a large institution, we have a framework for organizing ourselves. There are three parts to the framework. First, we're developing institutional competency to engage and sustain efforts to eliminate inequities. We're supporting and building community capacity to lead and engage in efforts to eliminate inequities. And we have identified partnership opportunities to enhance and promote efforts to eliminate inequities. How are we building capacity at the Boston Public Health Commission? We are deeply committed to building our own institutional capacity for doing this work through a professional education consortium that we established to train all 1,100 of our employees and through the creation of a working group to help us become an anti-racist institution. That's what we're calling AREC. So we're providing employee education and training opportunities. We're integrating elimination of inequities in every program that have to be submitted and in proposals every year. And we've identified and changing internal policies that may perpetuate inequities. We also have set 5-year overarching goals focusing on 3 particular health outcomes. We're realigning our existing resources to support 3 overarching goals aimed at eliminating inequities in health, and we're holding ourselves accountable for reducing the gap within the next 5 years. First, we're hoping to reduce low birth weight rates among Boston residents and reduce the gap in low birth weight rates between black and white Boston residents by 25%. We're also focusing on reducing obesity rates among Boston residents, and in particular, the gap that exists between white and black residents by 30% for children and 20% for adults. And last, we're reducing chlamydia rates among Boston residents 15 through 24 years of age and reduce the gap between black and Latino white residents by 25%. Another pillar for us is investing in community-based organizations and residents that are often in the vanguard of making significant change. We have realigned our funds to allow us to give grants to community-based organizations that work on a range of issues that can build health equity from job development to youth leadership. Some key project areas include data collection, raising public awareness, workforce development, youth leadership development, and food access obesity prevention. We've also launched our What's Your Health Code campaign that can be seen on whatsyourhealthcode.com. We're committed to working throughout the neighborhoods to raise awareness of the root causes of health inequities. And last year we launched the What's Your Health, Health Code campaign to focus on the relationship between health and place. Place matters. Where people live can affect how well or even how long they live, and it's time to start thinking about it, talking about it, and doing something about it. Our violence intervention and prevention initiative is also supporting community organizing to build peace in 5 micro neighborhoods in Boston that have the highest rates of violence. Community organizers and block captains are hired by local community-based organizations to support neighborhood-based efforts to promote peace through improvements to the built environment, connecting families and youth to services and employment, and challenging social norms. Building partnership is key. We believe the need to participate in policy and advocacy work, including working more closely with other city departments that address issues related to the built environment, economic development, and jobs is key. And here are just some initiatives that we have made headway, including quarry reform, paid sick leave. Our Board of Health Regulatory Authority has passed very aggressive laws on tobacco control, permitting and inspecting, and most recently our ban on sugar-sweetened beverages on city property. Another great example of how we're helping to advance health equity, a long time ago, as of 2000, about 10 years ago, we've made headway in the number of dumpster storage lots, junkyards, and transfer stations in Boston. As you can see here, the big difference between facilities in 1999 and a major reduction now in 2011. And many of these were found in our most, you see here, Roxbury and North Dorchester, where you were seeing, these are the most communities of color where you were finding these sites that were affecting health. Things to consider at the Commission, what we're trying to do is change fundamentally how we think about our work. So we ask ourselves different questions, which allow us to reframe what we do every day. So instead of asking how can we promote healthy behavior, we ask how can we target dangerous conditions and reorganize land use and transportation policy to ensure healthy spaces and places. From how can we reduce disparities in the distribution of disease and illness, to how can we eliminate inequities in the distribution of resources and power that shape health outcomes. From what social programs and services are needed to address health disparities, to what types of institutional and social changes are necessary to tackle health inequities, and so on. Working upstream, obviously, is key. Strongly opposing discrimination and racism in all settings. Support affordable, healthy housing. Promoting local opportunities for safe exercise and recreational activities. Promoting local opportunities for health, for healthy, quality, affordable food, and investing in public education and job training. And finally, there's a deep commitment to promoting policies that are good for health by working in partnership with residents and community organizations. And I hope I did okay, considering the time frame that I had.
Great. So thank you very much, and thank you again for stepping in and demonstrating what public health preparedness ought to be. So from that point of view, we now actually have a half hour for open discussion, question and answer. So I'd like to open it up to the audience to raise any questions you have to the panelists or continue the thoughts and questions, and we can also have the panelists ask questions of each other. Who would like to start? Somebody wants to start.
Question for Dustin here. You had a picture there of the different corporate agencies that should be held accountable for some health outcomes. And specifically, when looking at physical inactivity, I think you had the auto industry. But I wondered, how about technology? Industries that are responsible for creating technology that are also supporting inactivity for youth, etc. Do you see those also being held accountable eventually?
Sure, and as I said earlier, I've been focusing on a few because even that is a big task. But I think if you look at physical inactivity, there's a lot of evidence and amount of screen time.
Yeah,
sure.
The microphone doesn't travel, so if you could come up to stand. The question was about whether, in looking at concerns about physical activity, where industries that promote technology, TVs and whatnot, also have an effect, and Nick is answering that now.
So yes, I've been focusing on a few industries in order to be able to understand them in more depth. But I think if we look at physical inactivity, it's really a whole variety of things. It's the entertainment industry, the media industry that encourages passivity instead of activity. It's urban design that makes it harder for people to use active transportation. And it's certainly the automobile industry, which has promoted an individualized, environmentally destructive form of transportation here in this country and around the world. And we face a very serious circumstance when countries like India and China and Brazil understandably say to the countries that westernized, that developed earlier, to say, well, you used, you know, individual cars to advance and to offer that to people, why can't we do the same? And I think the answer to that is that the globe can no longer sustain that many more cars, and we need to, together, developed and developing nations, understand what are transportation policies that will sustain health.
Question.
But it seems like when you talk about these things, there's
So the question was about if you if you live in a place that doesn't have good public transportation and an emphasis on use of cars, how do you get a bias built in and even understanding what the alternatives could be? How do you begin to address that? How do you begin to address the norm that one uses cars?
Yeah, I think there it's more than bias. It's also the way that transportation dollars are skewed. Right now we're in the process of trying to reauthorize transportation bill. 80% of transportation dollars historically have gone to roads. There is a powerful road building lobby that has a stranglehold on lawmakers in terms of where the money goes. And if we are to talk about sustainable transportation, and if we talk about jobs, there are, you know, seven times more jobs, long-term jobs, permanent jobs are created by transit as opposed to roads. And so all the data will show that if we invest in transportation, transit infrastructure, we get a better bang for our buck in terms of air quality issues, in terms of access, in terms of improving access, traffic, in terms of use of gasoline, all of that. But where the bias comes in this country is that, and if you travel other parts of the world, it's just the opposite. You go to Europe and you have great transit. Transit is not considered transportation for losers, poor people, and, quote, minorities. In this country, having a car is a measure of success. That's the bias that has to be somehow flipped over if we are to address the issue of sustainability.
And I think there's a more... any question that you ask, we'd be able to maybe suggest the same answer, which is level the playing field.
Yeah.
That and how can we promote democracy? Because as long as we have a political system where the people who can afford to buy Congress and buy the courts and control elections, it's going to be extraordinarily difficult to reverse the influence of corporations sector by sector, level by level. And so we really need to think about how can we change the terms of democracy, change the terms of our political system. And that's why, again, I think the Occupy Wall Street movement is a breath of fresh air in really posing the question as what are the rights of the 99%, why is it that we've allowed the 1% to set the terms for so long, and what together can we do about it?
Question, here, please.
Dr. Pollard, my question really relates to your basic presentation, which basically shows that all the bad stuff is in the South. And just about everything, every negative factor you can think of is in the South. So my question is, what would be your answer to the question, why is that so? And there are a lot of easy answers. You know, one is because there are more of us there in the South, meaning African Americans. That's where the majority of us still live. What would be your response to why that situation?
So the question is, if you look at all the maps that Dr. Bullard showed, they tend to show that everything bad is happening in the U.S. South. What's the answer? Why is that the case? An easy answer put forward is often to blame those who are present, as in that there's a higher concentration of U.S. African Americans living in the South. So what would be an alternative answer?
Well, there's no easy answer for that. I'd suggest that you could probably find the answer in... by reading all 17 of my books. No, I think here's this whole issue. There is a correlation between exploitation of land and exploitation of people, whether it's on the U.S.-Mexican border, whether it's in the southern Black Belt states, or in the southern states that historically were part of the Confederacy, the resistance to civil rights, the resistance to environmental protection, the resistance to public-funded transportation. Some of the cities that were last to get public transportation were in the South. There is a resistance for using public dollars for the public good. And so, and in terms of public accommodations, historically there were laws that prevented certain populations from participating in certain public accommodations. There was a whole movement that was founded trying to equal the playing field. It was called the Civil Rights Movement. And it continues to this day. And so those legacy issues, those residuals of that residential apartheid that was in transportation, housing, employment, etc., still exist de facto. And so I think the way that you change that paradigm is that the fact that the Southern United States now is changing demographically, and that it's not a black-white issue anymore, that it's becoming more and more diverse in terms of the population, and if we talk about the areas where the South is the large, that Sun Belt, that Southern Tier, those states, that's the fastest growing part of the population in this country. That will be the population that will drive this country. And by 2042, the majority of people in this country will be people of color, with a large percentage that are in those Southern Tier states. And so it seems to me that it makes a lot of sense for us to start to address those inequalities, whether it's in school or education, employment, housing, whatever, now, as opposed to waiting until 2042 or 2050, when this country will be a lot different demographic than it is today.
What I'd also like to do is to actually add to that. The session that we just had before Spirit of 1848 was looking at questions about how to understand how discrimination harms health, and that's at multiple levels and over time. And I think that two things that come out, thinking about how we frame our science and how we frame the evidence that's presented. One is that in the study that we're doing, actually based in Boston Community Health Centers, is looking at people's place of birth, but framed as, were you born before 1965 in a state that had Jim Crow? And naming that explicitly is what the exposure is, to put the political measure out there. It's not just, as Dr. Bullard is also suggesting, geography. So it's actually saying something about the political institution that's shaping who was there. Were you born in such a state before 1965, after 1965, or somewhere else? Not to say that racial discrimination didn't happen in other states, but if you take any of this life course approach seriously, that's got to matter, and it's got to matter if you've then moved to Massachusetts and you're there and that was part of it versus were you born in Massachusetts. There are different social histories that then become embodied. So do we get to start naming some of the political as well as corporate and other economic factors that are shaping the health of the populations that we're talking about in these different kinds of studies that get presented? And I think the other theme that I would want to hear more in the questions that come up and the other answers is that we can be very good at diagnosing or saying what the problems are, but not always naming what the causes are the problems. And to start to name the political and economic causes, who's gaining from what these problems are, as some of these speeches are starting to begin, as I think part of what we want to hear is discussion from the audience. What does it mean to start to name not only racism the cause, but who's benefiting from it, who's harmed? What does it mean to name corporate practices as how they're benefiting from what they do, not just that we would like to see less harm cause? So I think that that's part of the consciousness that needs to be brought out through these kinds of presentations and why we had this particular session, to name who is the obstacles and what needs to be changed, because it's not that this is obviously A, random, or B, not without benefit to some groups. And how do we start to name that? This is where, again, I agree that naming the 99 versus 1% is very useful, but it can't just be economic justice devoid of racial justice, given the history that we have in this country and also other countries. Let's call on some other hands. Back here, there was a hand that was up for a bit. Yeah, you. No, you. Yeah, you with the right, the glasses on the head. You had your hand up for a while.
Thank you.
I don't think that needs to be repeated because everybody did this and also clapped. Are there comments from the panelists on this about the need to have looking at always the magnitude of health inequities and not just on average health or on average outcome, but always the inequities in that outcome? Yeah.
I agree totally. You know, San Francisco is at the top, and you go to Bayview Hunters Point, and they will tell you what's happening up there. The point I was making with a lot of these maps in terms of the best cities, the most livable, et cetera, a lot of it does hide these inequalities, and a lot of it does present this marketing, chamber of commerce, spin, kind of who's on first kind of thing, who's first. But at the same time, when you start comparing a San Francisco with Atlanta, and you see Atlanta being promoted as, quote, the black Mecca, and then you look at the difference between income and wealth, black wealth and black income in Atlanta, and then look at some other cities, you'll see that Atlanta will have... It won't make the best city, but it'll also have the highest wealth gap. But at the same time, you have this this Atlanta dilemma. It has the highest concentration of black millionaires, but it has the second highest concentration of black child poverty. And so those things get buried in because that's not some of the indicators that come with scaling.
So I appreciate your comment, and I think this is what's happening in Boston, that when you look at inequities based on different neighborhoods, the differences is huge. So when you take, for example, obesity rates in Boston, for black and Latinos it's 30%, but for white residents it's 17%. And so we're really holding ourselves accountable, and the way we're doing that is that we have to name and understand the role of racism in building these inequities. And so you see that where we're trying to do is to help through our campaigns in addition to help raise awareness. And I mean, there's a very compelling video about low birth weight that you can see when you go to our website. It's a person who, black female, who even though had the same level of education, same level of income as other white residents, the low birth weight was actually high for her as well. And so it was a study about racism and how the environment and exposure to stress over time impacted her ability to be healthy as well. So I think that naming racism is a start, and looking at what are those policies, racist policies, that are contributing to more inequities in Boston in particular.
Here, I saw a hand up here.
Rather than trying to look at the underlying determinants of those practices.
Thank you. Great points. I gave a talk earlier this morning at another session about the global health impact of McDonald's Corporation as a way of being specific about a transnational corporation, and talked exactly as you just did about their consumption practices, which I think is a big influence by the products they actually produce and distribute around the world, but also about their labor practices and their environmental and production practices. And I think the challenge is really to understand all those dimensions and how they fit together. And McDonald's, I think, provides a good example, because their business model is really built on three foundations. On the labor side, employing temporary workers, high turnover, low benefits, a lot of youth workers, and it's really a model for the 21st century employer that the workforce is disposable. And the fact is that something like 1 in 10 people in the United States have started their work at McDonald's, and so they've also become the educating into the workforce. You know, that's what a job is like, that the employer doesn't provide you with any benefits. You're hired and fired at a moment's notice. And so I think those things are very important. Some colleagues of mine in West Harlem Environmental Action spoke recently at a forum we organized on food prices, and they made a point that I loved, which is that when we talk about healthy food, we need to think not only about the nutrients in that food, but the workers who made it, and that healthy food can't be made by workers who aren't paid a living wage, can't be made by people who are exposed to pesticide or other toxic exposures. And that requires really expanding how we think about things. And I think looking together at the consumption practices, the production practices, the environmental practices, and the political practices of global corporations, that's where we need to get at. And to look for opportunities for bringing together people, because the soft underbelly of globalization is that we can globalize too, right? And I think we've seen in some of the campaigns, the corporate campaigns, that they've there's the beginning of bringing together labor groups and consumer groups and environmental groups. Your second point was about sort of why now and what made this happen, and I think it's exactly right. After a long period of prosperity post-World War II, I think there was a transition in the 70s, early 80s, into the the corporate world looking to take back what had been lost in that post-World War II period and restoring its control of the process. And that's how we understand, and really sharply attacking the, you know, sort of New Deal model of cooperation between government and industry. And so that's really what we're seeing. I think there have been cycles of between the balance between markets and government, and we're seeing what I hope is the high point of corporate control, and with resistance that I think it's become illuminated what the price for the world is through the financial crisis of ceding control from the public sector to corporations, and that's why I'm hopeful that we can see some changes.
Okay. Time for two more questions. There's one over here, please.
We talk about racism, we talk about
what why things are happening. We have obligations to provide under the treaty, and we also have reporting obligations. Every 6 years, we send a report to the UN service. Our next report is due this coming month, November. The UN Committee on the Elimination of All Forms of Racial Discrimination sends us back its concluding observations. We got the last one in 2008. It said, "Dear United States, thank you very much for your report. We remain concerned about residential segregation, disproportionate incarceration, unequal access to treatment, achievement gathering, education, all the things you're working on." So to what extent do you think really community folks might be ready to mobilize around international treaty rights? I mean, the first thing is to educate the public about the existence of this and other treaties. But do you think that that could be a tool?
Yes. As a matter of fact, for more than a decade, the environmental justice community has been using its analysis, its critique, as it relates to environmental racism, as it relates to discrimination. We've attended, you know, numerous summits. We were at the WCAR in Durban. We've had members of environmental justice delegations that have testified in Geneva. We've had special rapporteurs come to this country and tour Cancer Alley and tour communities that are victimized by toxic racism. We've had a number of communities that have actually traveled, as I said before, and presented oral testimony at, you know, the various human rights conventions. And so I think there's no lack of understanding or lack of willingness to participate. Communities on the ground understand that these are violations of human rights. And there's a case in Mossville, Louisiana, that has risen to the level where it has been accepted as one of those examples where the United States is basically in absolute violation. And it's an environmental racism case in a little community near Lake Charles, Louisiana. It's poison and all the documentation, etc. I do think the international stage is a stage to present the information on what's happening in this country as it relates to racism and its various flavors, whether it's incarceration or whether it's segregation or discrimination, etc. Lack of opportunity, lack of access to healthcare based on race. But it's a matter of those reports that get sent in, they get sent back, and people are saying, well, there are human rights in the world stage and there are civil rights which we can enforce. Hopefully the Justice Department, U.S. Justice Department, will take action, etc. But it gets to become a lot quite fuzzy out there in terms of what action will be taken. The United States is very quickly to talk about dictators and human rights being violated abroad, but will step back when political prisoners, etc., will step back when it comes to what's happening here domestically. So having our various organizations organized, mobilized, whether it's civil rights, faith-based, whether you're community-based or whatever, to basically talking about harmonizing our thinking about political prisoners, talking about basic human rights being violated, not having access to clean water is basically a human right that's covered by all this. Access to housing, you know, decent, affordable housing. All these things are, when we talk about abroad, we come up with a bully pulpit, but somehow the pulpit gets less bully when we're talking here.
So although I appreciate the question about international, I wanted to say that there are some environmental injustices here in the U.S. that we have to attend to. I'm a firm believer you have to put your house in order first and put it priority. So just to put into perspective really, really quick, a story about a relative who came from the Dominican Republic. So in the Dominican Republic, everybody aspires to come to the United States. So we are setting the example here. How we deal with racism here will be an example for how others can rise up in other countries. When he moved here, he basically told me one thing that really just surprised me. He said, "Daisy, this is the food country. I have never seen so many commercials related to food ever in my life. I watch TV and I literally want to get up and go buy unhealthy food." And basically what I'm saying, the point is that we have a lot of to attend to here, which can then be able to teach others in other countries, because everybody aspires to be like us. I was reasoning in the Dominican Republic, and I'm just surprised by how much advertising there are for plasma TVs in neighborhoods where there isn't even water and the light still goes out. So again, we're trying to bring our products elsewhere too, and so again, I just feel that we need to put our house in order.
Time for one more question, and then I'll have a closing comment. And I think that there was the hand that I saw in the back, in the very back of the room, has been up for a bit. Please.
So there's been a lot of debate about soda tax and whether it's unfair to poor people and whether it's putting the onus in the wrong place. And the way that I think about it is we need to be thinking about food policies overall. And I think what's clear is that our current industrial food production system that makes unhealthy food cheap by subsidizing corporations that grow, sell, distribute it is unsustainable. You know, unsustainable from an economic point of view because it's bankrupting our healthcare system, and unsustainable from a health and environmental point of view. And we ought to be dismantling the policies that have enabled that system to grow up. I would probably not choose to start with a soda tax, even though I support it, because I think it divides what the constituencies that need to be unified for a strong food movement. But I do think that a soda tax ultimately contributes to reducing disparities in health and benefits poor people more, and that's why I support it. I think the way to address those things is really to talk about, well, what would a comprehensive policy look like in transportation, in food, in pharmaceuticals, that would have as its center reducing inequities in health. And any one piece of it will always be problematic because it isn't the total solution. But by being able to talk about the whole picture and the vision of, in this case, a food production system that supports health, I think we'll be able to engage people in the discussion.
So we've come to the end of the session, and I hope that by listening to this wonderful set of panelists and also the kinds of questions that different people have raised from the floor, we have a sense of the importance of speaking to not only what promotes healthy communities, but also what the obstacles are, who and what they are. I was just at the Rio conference on the World Conference on Social Determinants of Health, as were some others here in the audience today. And a key tension that you could feel are those who look at the social determinants of health as things, versus those who look at it as the consequences of political and social relationships. And there's a real profound difference in that, and that naming what the obstacles are and opening up the possibilities, as also is the change in discourse that's being brought about by the We Are the 99%, really gives a chance to start to get at what is truly driving the things that do become specific physical biological phenomena that affect our health. So I hope that this is a session that allows us to start to talk about these things more explicitly. We can talk about corporations, we can talk about the imperative for profit, we can talk about practices which privilege some at the cost of others, and that challenging that privilege engenders backlash, and that we have to face that, and that's part of the work of public health. So I hope that some of the sentiment and ideas that came out, and that this is tangible, and has consequences for public health and for promoting health equity. So thank you for all for attending. Please come up and ask the participants questions.